So, can I introduce our panel today to you? The lady here is Ruth. Ruth is going to be looking after the panel and chairing the discussion. She's a long-time Greenbelter, really. You've been several times to the festival, haven't you? And she works for a Christian conservation. She'll tell you more about what she does, I expect, later. But she has a really good book that I recommend to you, L is for Lifestyle. So if, when you hear some of the stuff in the session today, you might want to pop along to the GE store and buy her book, I recommend that you do that. She might even sign it for you if you find her afterwards. You never know. We've also got the other lovely lady on the panel is Martha Musanza-Holman. Oh, she has a fan club, obviously, in the house. Martha looks after and runs the Love Zimbabwe stall, which, again, is just down the hill there. And if you've been and had a look at some of the very beautiful things that are on that stall, I would encourage you to take a look and maybe go and purchase some things from her later. Michael Northcott on the end here in the very, very lovely shirt, if I might say so. He was telling me earlier that he's got several books in the G-Store, but the book that he recommends that's something to do with this session is his book called A Moral Climate. So if you're interested in particularly the palm oil stuff, that's the book that he recommends to you. So, Larry, have I talked about you? I can't remember. Larry is from Tradecraft. Tradecraft, one of our associates. They've got a store in a stall in the G store, that's quite hard to say, G source, which is where all the big associates and partners are. I recommend you go and have a chat with them later if you're interested in what they do. And as I say, there's a couple of Tradecraft people on the door that will accost you on the way out. I'm going to stop talking because it's now 3 minutes past and it's over to you guys. But can you please welcome our wonderful panel? Thank you.
Great. Is this on? Are we all right? Yeah, wonderful. Well, good evening and thank you for coming along. I know that this is a little bit of a tricky time, isn't it? Particularly if you've got kids and you're needing to do tea and sort them out. So thank you very much for coming along to this. I think this is one of the most important sessions that is taking place across the event this weekend. Because in palm oil, we have one of the key issues that is impacting so many different things across our world, so many different people and places. I won't go into it because Larry is going to give us an introduction and an overview of that in a moment. But just to give you a little bit of a personal insight into that. And so I realize you said I would introduce myself, so I'd better do that. So I'm Ruth Valerio, and I'm Churches and Theology Director for Arosha UK, which is a Christian conservation charity. And I've often felt sorry for my kids because they've been brought up in a very ecologically and socially aware household. And there's a danger that they could react against that and that they could feel that they're a little bit weird. My eldest has always been really keen on all of these issues, but my youngest hasn't been until she read a book by Michael Morpurgo called Running Wild. I don't know if anybody else has read this or if any of your kids has read it, but I'd recommend it. And in Running Wild, it's about a young boy who ends up being stuck on an elephant after the tsunami. The tsunami, the elephant is on the beach and recognizes that the tsunami is happening, charges off into the forest, and this boy has this forest adventure on the back of an elephant. And as he does that, one of the things that he encounters is palm oil plantations. And through WWF, my daughter was already very interested in orangutans and in what was happening to orangutans. And through reading Michael Morpurgo's book, she made the link and the connection, this is probably about 4 years ago, between orangutans and palm oil. And when she finished the book, she said to me, Mummy, she was eight at the time, she said, Mummy, I don't want to eat any products that have palm oil in. I thought, oh my goodness, that's kind of what you dread as a mum, isn't it? But I said, well done. I think that's a fantastic decision to make. And to this day, 3-4 years later, she is still checking labels and she still refuses to eat anything that has got palm oil in. Why does she do that? Well, Larry is going to give us an overview as to the issues. But I hope that as a result of today, you will go away. You might not necessarily decide you're never going to eat or use any product with non-certifiable palm oil in it again. But I hope that you will make some decisions, that this next hour or so together won't just be interesting, but it might actually change some of the way by which we live our lives. But I want to hand over to Larry now, who's going to give us an overview and just open up this topic to us and explain to us the issues that are behind palm oil. So can we give him a little round of applause and welcome him up?
Thank you. Thanks very much, Ruth, for that introduction. I actually have to make a confession before I start that when I looked at the Greenbelt programme, I found that I'd been promoted by Greenbelt. And I'm not actually the chief executive of Tradecraft. I am a director of Tradecraft. So I just wanted to clarify that. But really what Ruth was saying about this topic is certainly what Tradecraft believes. This is a really important topic. And Tradecraft has always brought these kind of big debates to Greenbelt because Greenbelt people care about these big challenging issues that affect the planet and affect the people on the planet. And this is certainly one of those really big challenges. And we see it as a real new frontier for trade justice and fair trade. And this is kind of the first Greenbelt we brought this to, as something to air it and to listen to what you have to say, as well as tell you a bit about what Tradecraft has started to do. So what does link these things? It's a bit like a have I got news for you, kind of what do these three things have in common, which is the odd one out? And I've brought along some props actually here. So we have a Kit Kat here. Anyone want a Kit Kat? We have some toothpaste here. Anyone forgotten their toothpaste this weekend? Yeah? There you go. Oh, good catch. So, obviously, you've read the programme, so you know what link these things. Orangutans, I couldn't really bring an orangutan. It would have been good, but couldn't fit it in the suitcase. So, of course, the thing that links these things together is palm oil, which is not a very well-known ingredient, but is a hugely important global commodity. On the same scale or bigger than things like coffee and cocoa that we actually know lots about. And the reason that it is so important and such a huge global commodity is it's used in so many of the products that we use and buy in the shops every day. And in fact, it's used in over half of the packaged goods that we buy from the shops, grocery goods, bakery goods, snacks, biscuits, soaps, paint, toothpaste, all kinds of things. And it's used in those things because it is an incredibly versatile ingredient. It's all got all kinds of physical and chemical properties that are fairly unique that make it really important in making all those different things. It is going to become much better known very quickly because in 2015, January the 1st, 2015, it's going to become law across the European Union that every oil needs to be actually labelled on the back of pack for all food products. So you'll notice this, and everybody will notice this if you ever turn over and look at the ingredients, whereas at the moment, most of these products say vegetable oil, they will start to say palm oil, and that's one of the reasons why this debate needs to happen now, because awareness is suddenly going to grow. But you may well have alarm bells ringing, and depending on your level of knowledge and research on this, you'll probably have some kind of nagging doubt about, isn't there something slightly dodgy about palm oil from an environmental perspective? And you'd be absolutely right if that's the case, because palm oil is directly linked with some major environmental problems, particularly in the Far East, where huge areas of rainforest have been cleared over the past decades to make way for huge monoculture palm plantations at the expense of virgin rainforest. And it is on an enormous scale, to the extent that current UN projections are that by 2022, 98% of Indonesia's forests may be destroyed because of the global demand for palm oil and the push for more and more huge-scale plantations. Now, with that, with those clearances comes a huge impact on wildlife. So research shows that 90% of wildlife disappears completely when the natural rainforest is replaced by palm. Now, this isn't one of those kind of environmental statistics from 10 years ago. This is something that's happening right now, today, in the Far East. And WWF estimate that an area of 300 football pitches is being lost each hour right now. So this isn't a problem from the past. This is a problem that's happening right now. And orangutans are very well publicised as one of the victims of this, so to the extent that 90% of Sumatran orangutans, tragically, have now disappeared. Only 10% remain. And there are a number of really endangered species that could disappear if this continues. Another one is Sumatran tigers, as you can see, for those of you who can see the screen. Now, there is active campaigning going on, and organisations like WWF and Greenpeace have done a good job to start to highlight these issues and to make us all aware as consumers. However, big business that's buying the palm oil and using the palm oil hasn't responded in a way that's been particularly convincing so far. And when we looked at this as Tradecraft, we felt that something could be done which is not just the industry trying to get a little bit better. Maybe there's a more radical solution. So we started to look at this a number of years ago, and we asked ourselves the question, is there a practical alternative that is sustainable and good for the planet and also fair trade and good for people? Because one of the less known side effects of the clearances in the Far East is the impact on people as well. There's a lot of forced land grabs where smallholders and small growers are actually forced off their land to make way for the plantations. So in looking at this, we went back to the roots to say, where is palm oil actually from in the first place? And we could see that it actually comes from West Africa. And so we began to look into West Africa to say, well, actually, is there a part of the solution coming from West Africa? Now, the history of palm oil is that it all did come from West Africa. This picture on the screen shows barrels of palm oil in the port of Lagos in Nigeria in 1922. Awaiting export to the UK. We used to bring in palm oil by the thousands of tons into places like Port Sunlight. Unilever would bring it in, other companies would bring it in and make products like palm olive, the early margarines, and it became more and more used as part of the products we consume every day. Now, back in those days, palm oil was as important an export for West Africa as cocoa is today, which is absolutely phenomenal. Now, the other thing that we discovered, which was a happy realisation, that if you go to West Africa today, you will find that cocoa and palm fruits grow side by side, intercropped, often grown by the same smallholders. And that actually gave us a lot of heart, because in the cocoa industry, the role that smallholder growers in West Africa play for the cocoa industry is enormous. The vast percentage of cocoa that we consume comes from smallholders in West Africa. So that shows that there is a viable supply chain from smallholders in West Africa for cocoa. Maybe there can be for palm oil. So over the last few years, we've really investigated that. And what we've seen is there is a practical way this can be done. Palm oil can be grown in a sustainable way. We're actually looking at it in an organic growing. And it can be done in a way that's really good for people, and it does have the potential to lift people out of poverty. One of the things that happens at the moment, which is a real tragedy and such a waste, is that the palm fruit in West Africa typically goes completely unharvested and literally drops onto the ground and rots in palm bunches on the ground, unused. Meanwhile, the plantations are destroying the rainforest in the Far East. It's a crazy situation. So we could see that there's real potential to get things going. And the way Tradecraft does this is to just start in a small way, in a practical way, and demonstrate. And that's exactly what we've been doing. So we're working with a smallholder cooperative called Surrender Palm, who are in Ghana. And we have worked with them to get some volumes going. And we've started to import some palm oil into the UK. And we have developed a concept where we're taking smallholder West African palm oil and we're bringing it under the umbrella concept of fair palm. So this is something brand new. So it's fair trade and it's sustainable. And we've developed our first range of products to put this into. Palm oil is used a lot in detergents, things like washing up liquids, laundry detergents. So we've actually developed a range of products to use the fair palm, and it's called Clean and Fair. And I'm unashamedly branded up today, and I've got my reverse. So we're kind of calling this cleaning with meaning, because it's they're great cleaning products, but actually you're doing something meaningful by using these products, because you're helping people and the environment. It's the first product range in the world, household cleaning range, to carry the fair trade mark. And the range consists at the moment of washing up liquid, hand wash, laundry liquid, and surface spray. If anyone has had a shower at Greenbelt so far, you may want to confess this or not. If you go down to the shower block, you will find also that we have these bars of soap, which are made from fair palm and fair trade coconut oil. So it's kind of like a new take on palm olive. And it's fantastic soap, by the way. It's much better quality than the typical stuff. And this is the washing up liquid. So this is the world's first fair trade washing up liquid. Thank you. So you could consider that. If was anyone here at Greenbelt in the early 80s kind of time? So if you remember kind of fair trade coffee back in the 80s, it's kind of a new concept. It wasn't very nice, I accept, but it was a kind of brand new concept. This we're seeing as this is a kind of whole new frontier for fair trade. Fair palm, fair trade cleaning products. You've seen it here first. We're hoping this is going to become a really big thing and really mainstream. So the great thing about it from a people point of view is smallholders can earn a decent wage. There's a minimum price they're paid. There's a fair trade premium that they're paid. It actually makes a huge difference to income, and it means it's viable for growers to stay on the land in countries like Ghana. There's also processing of the palm fruits in a fairly small-scale, low-tech way that brings people together, and it's more added value as well for those communities. So they're gaining more from the fair trade than just growing it. And like all fair trade schemes, there's a fair trade premium as well. And in this example, in the cooperative, it's paying for clean water. Previously, this particular community had to go 4 kilometres to the nearest source of clean water. So they've been able to sink a well, and they've got access to clean water for the first time. So all of this means that there is a practical way we can play our part. This is a huge problem in the Far East. We're not at Tradecraft trying to pretend this is the whole solution to that problem, but it is a practical solution. It's something we can all do to play our part in helping people and helping to protect the environment and the rainforest. So thank you very much for listening to me. That's kind of my opening spiel. And back to you, Ruth.
Fantastic. Larry, thank you ever so much. It's it's incredible for me to hear where we've got to. And I love statements like the world's first fair trade washing up liquid, because I know from the work that my husband has done in terms of fair trade gold, that a statement like the world's first, behind that lies a huge amount of work and a huge amount of negotiation with fair trade, with producers, with organisations, working out behind the scenes what something has to be in order to be fair trade, working through the tick list. So I know that you can stand up here and make that statement, but behind that will have been years and years and a lot of hard work and a lot of sweat. So congratulations on doing that. What we want to do for all the rest of our time together, because this is a debate and predominantly we want this to be open to you for your thoughts and for your questions, is to take 5 minutes each for Martha and for Michael, and then we're going to throw it open to you. We've got a roving mic, and so then it's going to be open to you for your questions and your comments. But before we do that, Martha, it would be great to hear from you. Any responses that you've got, any comments, just your personal reflections on what you have heard? over to you. Thank you.
Great. Martha from Zimbabwe, all the way, now living in the world's first fair trade nation. Do we know which one it is? Oh, thank you. I'm really proud to be a person who is now a resident in Wales with a citizenship of Zimbabwe. I'm also proud to be here today talking to you all about my experiences of fair trade and what it means to me and to the people in Zimbabwe. I'm looking at this palm oil situation. When I was told about it, when I was recruited to be here, it never seemed to me that when I grew up in Zimbabwe, I've always used palm olive. I never knew where this palm olive was from. I started doing the research. Now I'm not going to tell you my age, but I've used palm olive when I was 7 years old, 6 years old, going to school. And I realized who was making this palm olive that is made in Africa, that is bought by people in Africa. I am talking to you on the perspective of a producer. A producer is suffering at the benefit of the big, massive company who is making money. I'm proud of the work that Tradecraft is now doing in West Africa, trying to help small-scale producers is the biggest issue. When I started campaigning in Wales for Wales to become a fair trade nation, I was there nominated as the only recognized resident producer because I make arts and crafts. I could not do food in Zimbabwe. As we know the situation in Zimbabwe, we can't own our own land. Our land is owned by big people. Palm oil is gold in Zimbabwe. Who owns gold in Zimbabwe is the biggest people, the rich people. The people are going to Amazon who are destroying palm oil are the people who have got money. It's time for us now, everyone who is sitting here, to think about what type of palm oil do we buy? What type of food do we put in our stomach? Is it fair palm oil or is it fair trade product? A lot of people think it's all finished now with fair trade. It's not. People are still suffering. I can tell you now, because of the destroying of the Amazon, because of the destroying of the forest in West Nigeria, in West Africa, we no longer have our westerly winds in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is down the equator. We depend on rain from up the north. It's no longer there. Why? We used to know when to grow food. It pains me now. I go back home. My people don't know when to grow because of this environmental crisis. So it's up to us now to react, to act and decide, and to tell these multinational companies. For example, we are talking of KitKat. We know KitKat is a fair trade chocolate. But how much of Nestle's product is fair trade? Just a little bit. I'm not happy about that. I think there should be rules about these big multinational companies that if they want to be fair trade, at least 50% of their products should be fair trade. Why 1%? We need to think as fair trade producers, as people who are trying to change a better world for a better future for our children and for future generations. Thank you.
Thank you, Martha. Lots to think about. I've written some notes there. Michael, over to you.
Great, thank you. I'm a trustee of Tradecraft. It's wonderful to be associated with this brilliant organization. I lived in Malaysia in the 1980s, worked for USPG, taught in a seminary. I got to know oil palm estates firsthand. I might say I learned to love the smell of paraquat in the evening because I used to go cross-country running with a thing, something called Hash House Harriers, which began in Malaysia, and we used to cross-country run. We follow a paper trail, kind of. It's a mix of orienteering and drinking. Some people say about the Hash House Harriers, it's a running club with a drinking problem, and other people say it's a drinking club with a running problem. I was somewhere between the two. But anyway, quite often we would drive out of KL of an evening at 5 o'clock. And end up on an oil palm estate. And we, you know, strip down, put your T-shirt on, off into the oil palm. So I really got to know these places at first hand. And in terms of wildlife, they are completely, almost completely denuded. Now, there were some enlightened planters, particularly for Unilever in the 60s, 50s and 60s, who used to do things like put in owl boxes. More recently, they've been trying to put in wildlife corridors through some of the oil palm estates. But the reality is, while some of the older oil palm estate companies were and have been trying to act responsibly, the industry is, as a whole, I'm sorry to say, not responsible. I woke up in a friend's vicarage last summer in Malacca. I mentioned this in another talk. I won't bear on it too much, but it's worth telling again. And I was on my way to teach in Indonesia last summer, and I woke up to a smell of burning. And I thought, that's strange. Jason's a vicar, right? And, well, some vicars smoke, but he, you know, in Malaysia, vicars don't smoke. I thought, I don't think Jason is taking up smoking. Anyway, I'm not very risk-averse, so I'm afraid I just turned over and went back to sleep again. Anyway, the next morning, I got up ready to preach in the church for Jason, and I looked out the window, and you could not see the house across the street from us. There was so much smoke. The oil palm companies had paid subcontractors who'd paid other subcontractors just to burn Sumatra last summer. And there was an enormous pile of smoke all over the streets of Malacca, and it covered all of Malaysia right down to Singapore. The Malaysian government didn't complain. Why? Because it was Malaysian government agencies, including the biggest political party in Malaysia, who own a good deal of the stocks in the oil palm companies who were that summer, last summer, burning Sumatra. And sad to say, every summer, the city I used to live in is now shrouded in some degree of haze from oil palm burning. It's utterly unbelievable. And the human effects are terrible. We've heard quite a lot about the wildlife effects, and I love orangutans as much as the next person. And I've been to Sepalok, which is a wildlife and orangutan sanctuary, and they're just wonderful creatures. They're the closest to us in a number of respects as species, one of which is their children take 5 years to develop to a point where they become independent. Now, they are the only other species that stays that long with their progeny. Most progeny, when they turn up on the pavement or on the field, they know what to do. But orangutans are more like us. They do not know what to do. They have to learn it. And it takes them 5 years before they can go off into the jungle on their own. So they're very, very close to us. And in the Malay language, Indonesia and Malay, the word orang means person, right? And utan means jungle or just outside. So it's the person that lives outside, not inside. So in Malay culture, they're that close to human beings that they give them almost the same word. We're orang and they're orangutan, right? Well, I'm an orang putih, actually, because a putih means white. So I'm an orang putih and then the orangutan. You get the idea. Well, I think, brilliant that we've managed as a company and through the fair trade movement to find a way to address this very fundamental issue. Because what we've succeeded in doing in the fair trade movement so far has primarily been agricultural products. It's been much harder to get behind some of those to essentially industrial supply chains. And what we're talking about with oil palm is not simply an agricultural product. It enters into a whole supply chain. You'd be amazed at the things that come out of oil palm once it's cracked in a refinery, including, of course, biodiesel. So anyone here who's driving a diesel car will almost, well, it's unavoidable that you will have oil palm from Southeast Asia in the tank of your car. I mean, it's shocking, but it's true. So to find a way and a better way than the industry came up with a roundtable on sustainable palm oil. Unfortunately, the certification has not been reliable. And indeed, a number of the plantations that burned in Sumatra last summer were RSPO certified. So it's not been a reliable labeling, and it's not given us a supply chain that we can say is genuinely from old plantations and not displacing people or orangutans. But I just want to end on this note. Many years ago, I went up the Rajang River in Borneo with a couple of students on a field education trip. I took my two kids. We cross rapids on these boats with kind of an engine balanced on the back of the great big propeller. It was amazing. It was a real developing world trip, and it was fantastic. But when we got into Balaga, the kind of bush town where we were visiting some churches and longhouses, we met a flying doctor. She was working out of a helicopter who had earlier met in Cebu, a Christian, Chinese Christian. And she told us stories about visiting communities of Iban and Dayak on hillsides around Borneo, Malaysian Borneo, and they were suffering from malnutrition. Now, the tropics is the most abundant place in the world for food. It's just extraordinary how much food just grows in the jungle. But these people, you didn't see it from the river because the companies had cleverly left a little band of 20 meters of rainforest by the river so the tourists don't see it. But up high, when they strip for a plantation, they strip. And you just end up with completely bare land. And then they terrace it with bulldozers. And you get this effect of kind of terracing all the way down. And nothing is there by the time they finish until the plants come up. So maybe the figure of 90%. I'm not sure what 10% remains. Of course, some wildlife then comes back once the plantation comes up. But the thing was, these were human beings suffering from malnutrition in the most fertile ecosystems on Earth. Their livelihood, their lives, their villages, their forests had been taken from them by this industry. So again, I think this is completely wonderful. And I'll say one last thing. I work for the University of Edinburgh. It's a large corporation. It's not a small one. It's not easy to persuade an organization as large as the University of Edinburgh to take on a new, to change its procurement practices in relation to any product. But we are a fair trade university. I've spoken to our procurement officer, and I connected her with Larry, and they have taken a sample of the product. They follow these European competition rules, but I'm still really hopeful that we as an organization will take this product into our supply chain. But my point is a challenge to some of you. Some of you may be in similar workplaces, and local authorities, schools, hospitals, businesses, all of them are using cleaning products. They have to. So there's a great opportunity for the fair trade movement just here in this room. If all of you could go back to your organization and say, hey, here's a new product. We should be doing this. It will be good for our brand. It will be good for the image of our organization. And it will help the people and the orangutans in Southeast Asia. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So we are touching on a very big issue here, aren't we? And thank you for all of the input that we've had so far. But we want to hand it over to you now, particularly for your questions, but for any comments. It's obvious that the expertise that we've got sitting up here, and I'm going to hand it over to you. We've got a couple of roving mics that can go around. If you're like me, you'll be sitting here bubbling away with all sorts of things. So don't be shy, stick up your hand, and let's take some questions. Okay.
Hello. The fair trademark, as it is a great idea. I just wonder, is there any transparency as to how much farmers actually have to pay to be a part of the scheme? Because I heard that it's quite a substantial sum.
Yeah, I think the fair trademark has some huge benefits about it, as you say, because it brings with it some certain guarantees for farmers. It brings a guaranteed minimum price, which is fundamental. It allows smallholders to start planning. And it also usually brings a fair trade premium that benefits the growers and also the wider community. I think you're also right to say that the fair trade certification scheme can be a bit of a burden for farmers too, because like all these kind of things, there's audits and there's payment. And at Tradecraft, we very much support, we were co-founders of the Fair Trade Certification Scheme, so we believe it plays a valuable role. But also we shouldn't believe that it answers all of the problems. And there is sometimes a place for fair trade that isn't covered by the mark. And in fact, the Fair Palm scheme that we're talking about is separate from that, and it doesn't have those kind of costs. So there are some brilliant things about fair trade certification, but it's not always the answer to everything. And for growers, there's a balance between the benefits and the costs. So yeah, I think you've made a good point.
It was mentioned about how long it took for fair trade coffee to come mainstream. In 20 or so years, that's a long time in fair trade. So when do you think palm oil will become in the supermarkets?
So the question is, how long is it going to take for fair palm? Is it going to take another 25, 30 years? It's a really interesting question. I hope not. I hope it's going to be a lot quicker. I think one of the things that we've got going for us is the last 30 years in fair trade, a lot of the hard work that we have all done, something I feel very proud about, the church and the Christian community has played a massive role in this, and all kinds of other community groups have too, in raising the awareness of what fair trade is. So one of the benefits that we have is there is already that level of education and awareness that we have to work with. The task ahead in terms of palm oil is quite a complicated story. It's not as straightforward as something like coffee or cocoa. So the task that we all have, and I'm really hoping that we can kind of take this on collectively, because it's a big task, is to kind of start with, let people know that there is something called palm oil that we all have something to do with. We all consume it every week of our lives. We should take responsibility as consumers to see that the things that we believe in that are happening on coffee and cocoa also happen with all of these products that contain palm oil. And the great thing is it's going to start becoming visible. Up until now, palm oil has been an invisible ingredient. But from January the 1st, 2015, palm oil will be labelled on the back of every product. And I think what we need to do as communities and as individual consumers is to hold people account to say, if you're putting palm oil in that product, where is that palm oil from? Is it good palm oil? Is it bad palm oil? Great thing I've heard someone say recently is, if your products could speak, what kind of story would they tell you where they came from? And I think that's a question we need to ask to big companies, to brand owners, to retailers, that those companies and those individuals who run the companies are responsible for that, and we need to hold them to account as their customers.
Martha.
Can you hear me? Is it? I was so shocked when I heard about palm oil being in loads and loads of products. I never realized that even in bread we've got palm oil. I went to a big supermarket just wanting to buy bread with no palm oil. I just found one small bread, one tiny bread, which didn't have palm oil, or which said organic palm oil. Until you go and find out, you realize that there are so many products in supermarket that have got palm oil, but it actually doesn't mention where this palm oil is from, or whether it's organic, or whether it's fair trade. But there is a lot of palm oil out there. We just need to find out where is it coming from.
Thank you. And I would just say that the answer to the question, how long is it going to take for it to get into the supermarkets, lies with us. And I've found over the years that the supermarkets do respond to consumer pressure. And coffee took a long time. If you look at the supermarket response to bananas, that was slightly shorter. And I know that the only reason why supermarkets have fair trade bananas is because of consumer pressure. So if we can go back and do the same thing over this issue, then we will be able to make a difference.
Can I just follow that up? Volume and pricing are crucial when it comes to marketing fair trade products so that they're competitive. Can I ask whether the pricing of these new cleaning products is actually at a competitive level or likely to be at a competitive level soon? Because one of the issues that for fair trade bananas, which have been around a long time, Tesco say they couldn't possibly sell exclusively fair trade because they can't source enough bananas. I can't discover whether that's actually true or not, but it's a convenient get out for them at the moment.
Okay, good answer. Yeah, I mean, the pricing is really important, as you say. What with launching this product and this range, we set ourselves the target to say it would be no more than the cost of an eco brand like Ecova plus 10%. In fact, we were able to bring it in more competitively, and a lot of the range is either the same or lower in price than Ecova. One, I would say there is a bit of a myth that is around the industry about if you buy a sustainable fair trade palm oil, it's going to add enormous cost to the end price of a product. Now, to give you an example of that, fair trade fair palm that we're using, because we're operating on a small scale at the moment, is more than double the price of conventional palm oil. Now, when you get to the end of the supply chain with a finished product, the difference that actually makes to the end of the finished product is only a couple of pence. So it is a myth that is kind of put out there by the major companies. And I recently went to a conference where people like Cadbury's and Procter & Gamble and Unilever and people were there. And the very, very clear thing about this whole debate is all of those companies were keen to see a sustainable solution, but not one of those companies was prepared to pay one penny more for the palm oil they source. And I think that is at the absolute crux of this. And it's unacceptable. These are companies that pay millions and millions of pounds on other activities like advertising their products every year, but they're not prepared to pay one penny more on sustainable ingredients. And that's exactly the kind of thing that we need to challenge them on and hold them to account. Because there are practical solutions. It would be very, very possible to have fair trade detergents from all of those brands, and it would add a fraction of a pence to the finished price.
Yes, Larry, you said that by 2022, the UN estimates that 98% of Indonesia's rainforests will be destroyed. I think I got that right. So this is a very imminent and urgent problem, as we're in 2014 now. Is there any pressure that can be applied to the Indonesian government? Do they allow this to go on? Or they just turn a blind eye to it, or these burning of the jungle and so on, or how does it actually happen that this goes on?
Well, the good news is that Indonesia got a new president this summer, and he really is a good guy. Now, that is a big deal, Indonesia, because Indonesia is a very corrupt country, and it's been very corruptly governed during the Dutch time and ever since. And Dutch colonialism in Indonesia, I mean, we haven't got a lot to be proud of in the British Empire, but I tell you, what they did was unbelievable. In fact, Max Havelaar, which was associated with the Fair Trade brand, is a novel. It was written as a sort of fiction, but everyone knew it wasn't just a fiction, by a colonial officer of the Dutch civil service who was so horrified by what he was required to do that he resigned his commission within a year, went back to Holland and wrote about it in Dutch so that people in Holland could find out about it. And that novel within 10 years led to a change, led to big arguments in the parliament and a change in the practices. But by then it was too late. If you talk to Indonesians, they'll say, well, what did the Dutch give to us? Drains. And that was about it. I mean, it was really shocking. But my point is that the corruption of Indonesian politics has a long history, and part of it's colonial. But there is hope. The new president is a lot better than the last guy, and I think we should pray for him. He was formerly mayor of Jakarta, and he was known in Jakarta as a guy that if he heard about you taking money, he would sack you. And so many public officials take money in Indonesia. So that is really amazing. So I think there is some more hope for Indonesia than there was before the election this summer. And the other thing I would say is that Greenpeace, you know, they don't get everything right like every other organization, but I really take my hat off to Greenpeace on this issue. They have been campaigning for some years on oil palm in Indonesia, and in particular in Sumatra, and they persuaded the biggest company, which is again partly Malaysian, to stop their activities in clearing rainforests in Sumatra. Now, it's not the only company, of course, involved, but nonetheless, I think that Greenpeace's pressure is making a difference, in addition to, obviously, the idea of a fair trade certified oil palm, which is not from Virgin Forest. So I totally take what Larry said. It might happen. But there are two things there that I think are hopeful. And Indonesia is it's 1,000 islands. It's really an incredible place. But it's the government of those 1,000 places is incredibly complex, and there's a great deal of corruption. Quite a lot of it is at local level. And so it's the state government in Sumatra which is often taking the payments and allowing all this stuff to go on, turning a blind eye. But as I say, I think there is a little hope at the moment in Indonesia about these issues.
Hi. Thanks very much. Can I ask two linked things? One is there any possibility of encouraging fair palm within Indonesia, for example? Because I foresee some difficulties in effectively selling to Indonesians a movement which will appear to Indonesians as taking trade away from them and giving it to another part of the world. And linked to the previous question about governments, it always troubles me slightly to see fair trade as being a totally Western orientated consumer movement if it doesn't link with civil action and civil education within the developing world itself, with empowerment at the other end, if you like, and not just the educated consumer in the West. So I wondered what thought you've given to that and how Fair Palm's going to link with civil empowerment, good governance, and all the other issues that underpin changing structures and not just a small part of trade.
Yeah, so the first question about fair trade palm oil in Indonesia, I guess that the view that we're taking at Tradecraft at the moment is that there's so much to be done in West Africa, and it's such a big task with huge potential, is that we're focusing our efforts on West African smallholders. There is huge potential for much more palm oil to come from West Africa, in a sustainable way, in a way that really benefits people who need to feel that benefit. That's where our focus is. There are, as Michael has spoken about, there are schemes that are happening in the Far East, in Indonesia, in Malaysia, under the umbrella of RSPO, the Roundtable for Sustainable Palm Oil, that aren't convincing people that they're working very well at the moment. But there may be scope for improvement. There may be social benefits that come with that. To be honest, some of this is about our capacity as an organisation in Tradecraft that we feel we have to focus our efforts in one place. It's such a vast thing. So we're very much focused on West Africa, but we're looking for solutions that help the Far East as well. There are all kinds of NGOs and interested people who are working in this area. So we are optimistic that there could be solutions there for Indonesia and Malaysia too. I think the second part of what you said, I wholeheartedly agree with it. You know, fair trade can never work if it's a kind of Western idea that's imposed on people. It has to be something that, in this case, the smallholders that we're working with in Ghana fully embrace and feel ownership for, and it has to go wider than just the transactional trade thing. So it's very much our approach is to work at looking at the community needs and playing our part to enable that community to develop and to grow and to flourish. So we definitely agree we need to look at the bigger picture. It's not just about the transaction of trade.
I've seen on a lot of jars a little palm tree logo and a thing that says sustainable palm oil. Is this any better than any other palm oil?
That palm oil comes from is certified under the RSPO label. So that's a round table on sustainable palm oil, which was begun in Kuala Lumpur by planters, some of them associated with Unilever, one of whom I know is a very active Christian. So it was very well intentioned. But unfortunately, it's not proven. I mean, the idea behind RSPO palm oil is that it's not been grown on land that has been cleared in the previous 7 years. Now, I don't think this is a very strong standard, but even if we thought that that was enough to prevent them burning the forest down, which I don't think it would be, but even if it was, what it turns out that even RSPO-certified land has, and estates, the supply chain is not reliable, and I gave you the example of fires in north to central Sumatra last summer on the borders of RSPO plantations, which are almost certainly set by the plantation companies or their employees or subcontractors. So, yeah, I mean, I wish I could say it's better than the other stuff, but frankly, it would be better if it was olive oil from Spain. It would be better if it was another product. And that, of course, is another alternative. If it's a case that Ghana could not supply, and that presumably is the case, all of the oil palm in UK supermarkets, then we ought to be looking at other oils, which are only modestly more expensive, as Larry has been saying, because the price of the raw materials is nothing compared to the packaging, the logistics, the marketing. That's where most of the money is in industrial food, actually, not in the raw materials or the price paid to the farmer. So we should be pressurizing the supermarkets to use alternatives to oil palm, particularly when it becomes clear, as Larry said, next year, what has got oil palm in it. And you'd be amazed what's got oil palm in it. For example, tea lights. I mean, we love tea lights. They're all very touchy-feely and friendly, and, you know, they make your house feel so cheerful in the winter. I'm sorry to say most of them are made from oil palm.
Oh, Michael, you've just ruined us as a family. We're never going to be able to use tea lights again.
LED ones from Sweden instead.
Hi. My question is, are we being completely fair in criticising countries that are clearing their rainforests? Should we first be uneasy about our own history, starting with, clearly, we cleared our forests hundreds of years ago, but we've been clearing our natural habitats until very recently. The fenland habitats were still being cleared in the 1970s. Shouldn't this be making us feel uneasy before we criticise other countries?
Going off for some reason. Can you hear me? Yeah. Is it unfair? I think there is a lot of bad history that palm oil has that's connected with Britain and Holland and other countries where you could say that we kind of exported the idea of plantations. Did we export the idea of clearing the rainforest? Possibly, yes. I think what we do hear loud and clear, though, is if you talk to Malaysians and Indonesians who are actually living in the rainforest, who are able to grow palm as a crop in a small-scale way, they would say that they don't want to see deforestation happen. They would like to actually continue to live in that area. They'd like to benefit from growing palm oil and selling it from their small holdings. So the government of Malaysia may give you a different view, but I think if you speak to the kind of real people on the ground who are involved with this, they don't want to see a continued clearance. So it isn't just the kind of Western imperialist voice saying that. It is a voice that is in Malaysia, in Indonesia, in all these countries.
Well, also, it's not... What's happened with these things? I'm not saying it as criticizing these big multinational companies clearing forests in other parts of the world. I'm seeing it as an action towards, we have just realized that this is what is happening. It's something that we had not realized. Even like fair trade, look, fair trade came to save people in developing nations. So we are taking action towards, the land is being destroyed, but look at the adverse, what it is causing to the whole world. This is a world matter. This is something that we need to act upon, regardless of the history, what happened in the past. But also, we are looking at alternative ways of looking each other, creating a better world. That's how I see it myself. Let's act and probably forget about history or amend the history, but take action to what is there now.
My local county council and Tesco's proudly announced they use biofuels. When I asked them both, they weren't able to tell me where their biofuel came from or whether it's sustainably produced. And actually were rather rude when I asked. But given the amount of biofuel in particular that people are being encouraged to use, can palm oil production ever really be ecologically sustainable?
But biofuel, unfortunately, is a tragic mistake of the West and of the European Union in particular. The biofuel obligation of the percentage of fuel that is supposed to be derived from plants is a complete mistake. It's a complete mistake to use farmland in the States to produce gasoline from ethanol derived from corn. And it's exactly the same with oil palm. Now, of course, the oil palm industry will tell you, oh, no, our biodiesel is more sustainable than oil from under the ground. But you then have to look at the whole chain. And not only the growing and the chemicals involved in the growing, actually. My joke about paracrack, I mean, it is used widely. These are heavily laced. Not the smallholders, but the larger states use vast amounts of pesticides and herbicides. And then in addition, of course, the processing itself is energy, uses energy. And the carbon footprint of biodiesel from oil palm is, in my view, well, it's not just my view. There's plenty of scientific papers out there, but the scientists don't agree. This is always sometimes difficult. But there's enough, from my point of view, scientific evidence which demonstrates that its footprint is no better than conventional oil. It's better than tar sands oil, but we all know, probably in this room, how appalling tar sands oil is. But it's not better than conventional oil. So it was just a plain mistake by the European Union, unfortunately, to impose a biodiesel obligation on us as a way of saving the planet. And it's an example, I'm afraid, of the weirdness of climate politics, where rather than say to people, well, first to companies who can make more efficient engines, no, you don't need to do that. We'll just get around it some other way by claiming 10% of the fuel is not really from oil. Every single motor company has lobbied the European Union to prevent a higher standard of fuel efficiency being imposed upon them by 2020. I wrote to my MP about this, but of course, the UK government was on the side of the motor companies. It wasn't on the side of climate change and our descendants. And it's an absolute scandal. You can now buy vehicles that will do 100 miles to the gallon, but they're very few and far between. Meanwhile, luxury car brands like Lexus are using hybrid technology to carry on making luxury SUVs, which is slightly more fuel efficient than the ones that preceded them. It is a scandal that we have industrial high-tech ways of addressing vehicular mobility, which we could do without biodiesel, we could get higher efficiency without it, and we're not doing that. Instead, we're still burning down other people's forests to make our petrol and gasoline and diesel look better than it really is.
Thank you. We've got time for one more question, and then I'm going to ask each of our panel members to round up their thoughts and give us one thing that we can each do when we go away from here.
This is a quick question on world markets, particularly for these new products with new palm oil. I'm hearing a message that a lot of this is kind of UK-based, but I really wondered how this was echoed across Europe and the US, talking about the West as a whole.
So we're actually partnering with some other people on the project on fair palm from West Africa. We're working with an organisation called Dr. Bronner, who are based in the US, and they make soaps, and they're also sourcing this fair palm. And we're working with some other European fair trade organisations. So we're seeing it as an international project, and I think that's really good. We definitely complement each other in what we bring to the project. It's a massive challenge, this, as you're kind of hearing from this, and it needs to be an international effort with all kinds of people getting involved to really come up with the sustainable solutions.
Thank you. Okay, our time has pretty much come to an end. But I am an activist, and I hate hearing about an issue and going away not knowing what to do about it. So I'm going to ask each of our panelists to give you one
small, simple step that you can go away as a way and do as a way of responding to what we have been hearing about? Michael?
Well, in addition to buying and to going back home and looking under the sink and seeing how you can replace the products there with our products from Tradecraft, which I'm just assuming are all going to do that anyway, so that's assumed, right? If you particularly want to help orangutans and people in Sumatra and Borneo, I would really recommend also supporting, in addition to buying our product, and persuading your workplace to buy our product. Thirdly, I would say, join the Greenpeace campaign. It doesn't, you know, £2 or £3 a month. Go online, see what they're doing about it, and add your voice. Write to your MP about it. Write to the European Trade Commission about it. We can make a difference through organizations like Tradecraft and like Greenpeace. And Greenpeace on this, I think, is really making a difference. And I think, you know, please support that campaign if you can.
Great. Thank you. Martha.
As you all know, I'm from Zimbabwe. I need your prayers. I need you to pray for the people who are suffering in Africa, who are suffering because of these problems that are created by other people. I want you to go back to your community, whether you're coming from a church, you're coming from a school, whatever we have shared with you today, just go and share with them and just try to find out how much difference you can make by realizing how the world is falling apart because of multinationals. Thank you.
Thank you. And Larry?
I'm bound to say this, aren't I? Please buy the Clean and Fair range. Start cleaning with meaning. If you can go away from today, tell other people you're camping with about it. Tell people when you go home. But beyond that, look out for palm oil being labelled. It's going to be on the back of packs everywhere in January. Look out for that and start the process of pointing it out to people, because it does need to be this kind of process of education. People need to become aware and then take action.
I'd like to really thank the panel. That's really enlightened me. I admit I didn't know half the stuff that you've spoken about, and I am really grateful. If another way of being active in this is this session was recorded, you could, after the festival, download that session and play it in your churches or in your groups, maybe, and we can spread the word that way. So that's just one other way that we can get this message out, I think. We have run over, but only by a little bit. But can we give the panel a massive thanks? Thank you very much. I'm really grateful to you. Thank you, guys.